Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone. This is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and you also happen to be in Florida. Your large intestine is in Florida with me right now on vacation. And I hope you're having as much fun as me, because it has been so great. We're here for the 4th of July, and I'm telling you, I haven't had that much fun in a long time. And it's hot. It is really hot. As one of the members of my group said, it is hot as blue blazes. Yeah, it's cooking. It's not a heat that I am used to, but it's certainly beautiful. And the thunderstorms at night and the people, everybody's so nice. Everyone says hi to you. People in the stores talk to you when they're checking you out. You know, you're at Target and you're closing out and they're just like, they're totally like talking to you. Like, I have not had that experience in a long time. People in LA and California just seem to absolutely hate their jobs and hate you. And I don't know, it's wild. But anyway, let's keep it positive. Florida is the bomb. All right, so I have Constantine as our guest again today. And this is fantastic. He really combs through the thyroid information some more to help us all figure out how to support a hypothyroid and slow metabolic function. This stuff is getting really important to understand. And the more we hear it, the more we comb through it, the more we're going to be able to understand what we can do about it and to recognize that you have it. Almost everyone has this issue. I just posted... I'm about to post a meme here soon on Instagram about Candida, which one of our guests already mentioned. Candida thrives in a low body temperature. And a low body temperature is a classic sign of hypothyroid. And hypothyroid doesn't always show up on a thyroid lab. And Constantine talks about why this can be. Why stress levels can impact and show low TSH levels. And he's going to dig into that some more. And so it's important to test our pulse and our temperature for like 2 weeks every morning and about 40 minutes after your largest meal, just to see how often you are in and out of range. Because this is indicative when you're out of range on the low side, it's indicative of low metabolic function. And that means you're most likely operating on your emergency hormones and not on energy. And if you're hyperthyroid, which is very unusual, apparently, to be diagnosed as hyperthyroid, but usually what it can mean is that you are chronically hypothyroid and now you're running on your emergency hormones all the time. And so you're getting a hyperthyroid reading as adrenaline dominant, which is all part of the same metabolic problem, right? Which is also part of a mineral dysregulation as well, and a vitamin deficiency. And, you know, there's all of these other components to it. And it comes down to what you're eating, how you're managing your stress. You know, are you supporting detox at the liver and bowel? How's your gut doing? The same stuff we've always talked about on this podcast. It's just we're getting down, we're peeling the onion away to get more specific, because sometimes just working on gut health is just not enough, or working on mineral regulation is just not enough. I know that's a big argument out there, but the fact is I did the root cause protocol for almost 2 years, and you know, that's all about mineral regulation, and I still had all these other lingering things. So there are other pieces to the puzzle, and this is one of them for many people. Okay. I got off the phone with a doctor. It's so funny how, you know, I have to have a completely different attitude and like anticipate how I'm going to speak to them, because I know that we're not going to have like a really in-depth conversation about hormones, because they don't really know. And so, you know, He was, I'm surprised he didn't try to push statins on me because of my cholesterol. But he was pretty cool. He was like, you know, get the cardio, it's called a calcium, like cardiograph or something. It's like an ultrasound test that they take of your heart. I took one last year because my cholesterol was like 290. And then of course this year it's twice as high. And he said, look, if, you know, if you don't have any blockages in the ultrasound, then there's really no reason to fear. He's like, but it is unusual. And I'm surprised that you feel as well as you do, because people that have cholesterol this high usually are suffering from various different types of things. And, you know, I tried to talk to him about converting the cholesterol and he was silent, you know, he just didn't have anything to add to that.
He didn't say anything about
he didn't
that.
Really, I don't think he really understood what I was saying. You know, I'm trying to figure out the missing piece as to why I'm not converting my cholesterol into pregnenolone and not utilizing it as hormones. I said, I know that there's a genetic component to it, because my grandmother had really high cholesterol and she died of a stroke. And, but you know, she was also a smoker and a drinker and a lot of other things. And so, and then he just settled on that. He was like, oh yeah. Right. It's genetic.
Yeah. I don't agree with that at all, but
yeah.
But it's weird though, because you learn in biology in grade 9 that cholesterol is the precursor to all the steroid hormones. Like you know, I'm sure he knows that, or she.
Yeah.
Whatever. So,
yeah.
it's crazy that he wouldn't, they wouldn't mention that, but anyway.
Yeah. And then he said something funny when he looked at my labs. He said he looked at them last night and he said, what is going on with her? Is she off her meds? Which I thought was funny. He had a good sense of humor. And basically he was referring to the fact that I wasn't taking estrogen, and he said that I should be taking estrogen. And he said, your levels are so low, there's no reason you shouldn't take estrogen. And I was like, well, I've got some reasons, you know?
Yeah. That's crazy. That's crazy that he would say that,
mm-hmm.
especially because low blood levels of hormones just indicates that your ovaries aren't producing lots of hormones. That's really what that means. It's not, you know, a low blood level of E2 doesn't mean you're producing a little bit of estrogen. It just means typically your ovaries aren't producing that much estrogen. But like you know, estrogen can be lots of places that's not the blood, and there's different types of estrogen too. I'm mm-hmm. not sure if all of those were tested, but yeah, if anything, the blood test just shows that your ovaries aren't doing that much, which is normal at, you know, when you're not 30 and 40, you know, your ovaries aren't doing as much mm-hmm. in terms of hormone production. So,
yeah. So I want to talk about today kind of this stuff. I want to talk about dig more into thyroid, because a lot of, and diet, because a lot of people in the group, a lot of women are really getting confused and frustrated because the information is changing from things that, you know, we used to support and recommend before. Yeah. But my first question for you is like, and we can talk about whatever you want to talk about too, but let's start with like the thyroid can almost always is it, even when it's hypo, when it's sluggish, it can still show normal levels. Like this blood lab that I took into this doctor, he basically said, everything looks great, except you have low levels of this and that. So he didn't even comment on my TSH and all my thyroid numbers. Yeah. So the idea of testing your pulse and your temperature, and then what are other indicators? Because if it's not showing up in blood, then people just assume that they're fine.
Yeah. So sure, we can start with thyroid stuff, and then maybe later, if we have time, we can talk about, just so the viewers understand, we can talk about the fraud of estrogen, and, you know, people telling you should take estrogen to protect your bones. That's fraud. And, you know, there's many more. That's just one example. But
yeah.
For thyroid, lots of people would be very sick and they'll tell me, oh, but my thyroid's fine. And, you know, for lack of a better word, I just don't believe them, because I don't think that's true, because I don't think they or the doctors know exactly how to tell if their metabolic function's good, it's going well. So first, there's total cholesterol, and if it's high, like we talked about in the last episode, that typically means that the cholesterol is not being converted to the steroid hormones, like pregnenolone, and then pregnenolone becomes DHEA or progesterone, and then all the other specialized hormones from those two. So high cholesterol can be a great sign that there's not enough active T3, thyroid hormone, because that's one of the main things needed to make cholesterol turn into pregnenolone. But there's also vitamin A and stuff like that too. So total cholesterol is a great blood test. If it's high, that's a problem, especially if it's very high. TSH is another one. TSH could be low for the wrong reasons. If you're, you know, the TSH is a pituitary hormone. It's a brain hormone, not a thyroid gland hormone. So TSH stands for thyroid stimulating hormone. And if your body has very low TSH, that could be because it's given up on you trying to produce more thyroid hormone. Maybe you're chronically under eating. You are chronically under eating certain nutrients, like you could have a selenium or some other mineral deficiency due to not eating it in your diet. Maybe you're vegan, or maybe you're carnivore or keto and you're not eating enough carbohydrates, so your liver can't convert the T4 to T3. So there's lots of reasons that your TSH might be really low, and they're not all good. If it's low, and it's low because and then there's many other reasons, or maybe you are eating enough food, maybe you are eating enough carbohydrates, maybe you are eating enough foods with minerals like shellfish for the copper and the selenium, and, you know, liver for the vitamin A, and eggs for the B vitamins and stuff like that. But maybe you're also eating lots of bad foods that are hindering the conversion of T4 to T3. So you could have a great diet, but you also have bad things in the diet, such as, you know, margarine or soybean oil or vegetable oil. And, you know, they put these oils in these plant milks too. So the plant milks, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I'm healthy, I drink plant milk. Well, I think plant milks are one of the really harmful things out there. So even if someone is saying, oh, I get all my minerals, I get all my vitamin A, I'm not on a low carb diet, I get enough protein, they could still, even if they have a good diet, they could have bad things in the diet too, especially those PUFA, polyunsaturated fatty acids. All of that together could mean someone has a low TSH, because the body is saying, okay, let's make energy with adrenaline and cortisol instead of thyroid. So that's why TSH could be low due to stress. There's lots of things that could lower TSH, is my point. One thing that lowers TSH, a good thing, would be you have enough thyroid hormone, you're doing well, your pulse and temperature is great. So there's no need for your pituitary, your brain, to increase TSH, because why would they want to stimulate thyroid production if you're producing enough? So low TSH is the goal, but low TSH can be a result of extremely high stress and a bad diet.
So it has to be in the whole picture. That's why it's so important to be so consistent with taking your temp and pulse, because it's part of the bigger picture. It's not just the low TSH, it's low TSH plus temperature in range, plus all of the diet things that you're doing well.
Yeah, so you cut out a bit, but I think I got what you were saying. The my main point to people that are wanting to know if their metabolic rate is ideal is your cholesterol in a normal range? So it shouldn't be too high and it shouldn't be too low. So that's the first step. If you want to see if your metabolic function's going well, if it's good, you check your total cholesterol, and if it's really high, that's bad. Or even if it's just, you know, higher than it should be, that's just a sign, that's one sign that it's your thyroid hormone conversion is slow, because you need that T3 to make cholesterol into steroid hormone. So that's one test everyone should do, no matter, you know, what your age is, because, you know, any age you are, you can have trouble converting T4 to T3. And a lot of young girls with PCOS, that's the root cause there. They have very poor metabolic function, and you can partly test by testing your total cholesterol. And if it's high, that's one indication. The second indication is a high TSH. So TSH should not be high. We want it definitely lower than 2, but ideally lower than 1. But like I said, TSH can be lowered by many things, including stress. So if you have low TSH, that's not necessarily proof of something good, but at least it's not high. Because if it's high, let's say 2.3, 4, some women have 7, 8, 12, you know, those are crazy high. So if it's above 2, it's high, even though the range will sometimes it's up to 5. So anything above 2 is definitely high. And that's enough to say, well, you know, the body is saying we need more thyroid. So when you take a high TSH and a high cholesterol together, those are great signs that you need help converting T4 to T3. There's lots of dietary things to do there. But the best way, and this one is the one you can do at home daily, because you can't take blood tests all the time, even though those two particularly, they can help in particular. It's the pulse and temp like we talked about last time. So you want to take your pulse rate and temperature in the morning when you wake up upon waking. Within 10 minutes is ideal. I like the under the tongue oral thermometer, but the problem there is if people are sleeping with their mouth open, which they shouldn't be doing, their mouth would be much colder than it would have been if their mouth was closed. So a lot of people, I have 36.1 Celsius, which is, I don't know Fahrenheit, but very cold.
Right.
And that could be because they just woke up from 8 hours of an open mouth. I guess the solution there would be doing an underarm temperature, but I think that one takes 10 minutes. And who's going to sit there for 10 minutes? So I still think it's useful to take because at least you can see if it's going up in the long run. But it is important to take in the morning, I think, and, you know, try to sleep with your mouth closed. And there's people tape their mouth. Mm-hmm. All these things. But we don't have to talk about that now, but it's important to do the morning temperature. You can do an ear one. I think that one would be fine. A lot of people use the ear thermometer. And of course, the pulse rate, because if your pulse is, super high in the morning, that's an issue. And if it's super low in the morning, that's an issue too. I think the morning pulse should probably be in the 70s. If it's in the 90s or the 60s, that could be an issue. Mm-hmm. So that's the first time. The second time that I think would be helpful is before you eat lunch. So ideally you haven't eaten anything for a couple hours, maybe 2 hours or so, 3. Because this is important because you want to compare it to your pulse and temperature 40 minutes after you've finished eating.
So why is that?
Yeah, so a good meal, a good response to a meal will be that your temperature has risen after eating and your pulse rate has risen after eating. So ideally, when people send me their numbers, this is an example of what I would love to see. Before they eat, so they haven't, you know, they didn't just eat a snack or something. They haven't eaten for 2-3 hours. They're going to eat lunch now. So right before they eat, they take their temperature. Let's say it's 36.6 Celsius, or let's say it's, you know, if we're doing Fahrenheit, let's say it's, you know, 98 Fahrenheit. And let's say their pulse rate is like 75, 76. They eat their food. They finish the last bite. And then 40, 30, 50 minutes later, it doesn't have to be exact, but at least half an hour later, they check it again. Their pulse rate should be higher now, maybe high 70s, low 80s, 82, 83, right? And their temperature should rise to 37 degrees Celsius, and that's 98.6. Now, it's totally fine to also be 37.2 or 99 Fahrenheit. That's fine. That's what I want to see. I want to see a good temperature and pulse on the lower end. You eat, you wait 40 minutes, and now you're hotter and your pulse is better. That means that the meal has fed you, it's lowered stress, and it's increased your metabolic rate. You've increased your heat production, so you're hotter now. You're 98.6 as opposed to 98. You're 99 even, that's fine. Your pulse went up a bit, but it's not too high. Because if some people eat and their pulse goes up to 95, you know, something's wrong. The meal gave them a stress response. Maybe it's really irritating their intestine, or maybe they're getting an allergic reaction, slight allergic reaction to the food, and something like that. It's increased
like
adrenaline.
If like you eat too much, like if you're too full, I notice when I eat too much, my heart will race. Like if I'm like, oh, I just ate way too much. Like that kind of, that's also a stress response, right?
Well, yes, too much, but also the wrong type of food. So for example, if you eat a lot of starch without fat, that's an issue. So let's say you eat, an example of starch is white bread or white rice or a potato. So for the listeners who don't know, starch is basically just a long chain of glucose. It's only comprised of glucose. So when you eat starch, it rapidly becomes glucose, goes into the bloodstream, and you have very high spike in glucose if you just eat the starch. And then that's going to cause insulin to go really high. And in normal people, the glucose, because of that huge spike in glucose and the subsequent spike in insulin, the blood glucose will lower rapidly because the insulin is there to lower blood glucose. And the insulin will over, you know, lower the blood sugar, and you'll have hypoglycemia. And when your blood sugar is low, cortisol and adrenaline are there to, you know, make sure the blood sugar isn't too low. Mm-hmm. And adrenaline, cortisol will rise when you have low blood sugar caused by the, you know, heavy starch meal that rapidly increased glucose in the blood. And then your heart rate could be really fast.
Okay.
So what's the solution here? Well, fruit is great because fruit is not starch. It's not just glucose. Fruit also has fiber, like in an apple. So it's going to be slowly releasing the sugars. Instead of white bread, starch will immediately turn into a lot of glucose and immediately go to the blood. But fruit is not starch. It's not glucose. It's sucrose usually, which is fructose and glucose. And like I said, the fiber and stuff helps. It's the slowly get absorbed. So what's the solution if you don't want to eat fruit or honey or maple syrup and you are eating starch? I do think starch can be a good, you know, the safer starches are a good thing to eat, mm-hmm. but they have to be with fat if you're having starch. So if you have a potato with olive oil or ghee or butter, the fat will make the glucose from the starch slowly get into the blood. So instead of having a huge jump in blood glucose, you'll have little increases of, you know, absorbing the glucose into the blood. So you won't have this huge increase in glucose causing a huge increase in insulin causing hypoglycemia. So the point is, when you eat starch, bread, potato, rice, corn, oats, like oatmeal, that's all starch. Beans are starch too. I don't recommend beans. I think the safer starches are the ones I mentioned before. No, the safer starches are not bread. The safer starches are potatoes, white rice, oatmeal, and nixtamalized corn, which is corn treated with lime, like masa harina, for example. But I mean, if you just eat regular corn, I think that's okay too. Those are starches that I think are safe. And with a safe starch, you have fat with it, so it doesn't cause that blood glucose issue. So that's just one example of why a meal might give you really high blood heart rate. So, you know, and another thing about that is, if your heart rate is really high and your temperature is high before you eat, and one or both of them lowers after you eat, that's a good thing in the sense that the meal lowered stress, but it's a bad thing because it shows you that before you ate, you were running on a lot of stress. Because if eating lowers your temperature, then eating has lowered stress, making the temperature or pulse lower. So, you know, that just means that you had high stress before. So mm-hmm. ideally, you'd be a good temperature and pulse before eating, but you'd be hotter temperature and faster pulse rate after you ate, because that shows that you weren't running on a lot of stress hormones prior to eating. You had a normal temperature. And now you're hotter because you ate. So that's why it's very important to see the comparison. And it's good to track these for days, write it down, and even graph them. And I love to look at the graphs because you want your after lunch graph number, let's just use temperature, to be higher than the line of your prior to eating graph numbers. Mm-hmm. So you want it higher, but you want them both, you know, if you do a trend line, you want to see them trending in a good spot. So ideally, you want your average temperature prior to, after eating, to be 98.6 Fahrenheit, right? That's what you want. So if some day you're at 99, some days you're at 98.4, that's fine. But if you take it for 3 weeks, let's say, and you graph it out, or you just take the average, you don't even need to graph it, just take the average, that number should be 98.6. If your average temperature is 98.2 40 minutes after eating, that's bad. So it's very important to not just check your pulse and temperature, but to record it, check averages, see where is it headed. Am I getting hotter over time, colder over time? Am I all over the place? You know, is someone having 97.9 one day and 99.2 another day? Like that's too all over the place, but it's very possible. So mm-hmm. you got to check your pulse and temp, record it, and watch how it's progressing over the days, over the weeks, over the months. And total cholesterol and TSH are important too. You want, mm-hmm. just to reiterate, TSH ideally lower than the two, best lower than one. Total cholesterol not very high. Pulse and temperature within range, high 70s, low 80s for the pulse, 98.6, 99, 97.9. That's the range for Fahrenheit for temperature. And then for Celsius, 36.6, 37.2. That's pretty ideal.
Hey everyone, I wanted to introduce Ona's new ultra-concentrated CBD progesterone cream. It's 5% CBD and 3% progesterone for relief of stress, anxiety, minor aches and pains in your muscles and joints. It is U.S.-sourced, produced, and naturally derived. It's organically grown. And right now, we are doing a special because this particular strength of CBD on the market, which is THC-free, normally goes for about $120 for 2 ounces. So we are doing $60 as an introductory offer. And the reason I developed it was because this particular combination with the CBD helps to downregulate cortisol while it helps you to take advantage of the progesterone benefits. The link is in the show notes, or you can go to us.onasnatural.com. And by the way, if you use coupon code ONAS, you'll get an additional 10% off. So are there any other reasons besides, you know, thyroid, sluggish thyroid that people can be having these problems? You know, like, it seems like checking your thyroid and having a sluggish thyroid seems to be at the base of just about every single imbalance now. That, you know, the more that I dig into this and the more I'm reading, it just seems like, you know, everything, like, you know, high cholesterol, or you can even say actual diagnoses, like, you know, like high blood pressure, diabetes. You're not going to find somebody with these kinds of non-communicable diseases that have a normally functioning thyroid, right? It's just not possible.
Yeah. I just want to clarify though, this isn't, you know, we're calling it thyroid function, but this is not, these aren't tests for your thyroid gland function. It's
metabolic function.
Yeah, this is how we determine, are we producing energy efficiently? Are we producing energy how we should? Are we, you know, do we have good thyroid conversion? So if anything, this is more of a test of your liver function, not your thyroid function. So this is, I actually wouldn't even say this, it's just easier to say check your thyroid, but we are not talking about the thyroid gland pretty much at all. Like we talked about in our first episode, if you have really low pulse or really low temperature or really high cholesterol or really high TSH, if you have one or all of those, it's possible that your actual thyroid gland isn't producing enough hormones, but it's pretty rare. It's typically going to be an issue somewhere else that's causing your liver to not convert the hormones. And that's why it's very tricky when people say, oh, how do I increase my pulse temperature? Because everything good increases your pulse and temperature to a good zone, not too high or too fast for a pulse. And everything bad will lower that. So if someone says, oh, how do I get my, you know, 37 degree body up to 38.6? It's impossible to say unless I see so much information. Because first of all, if you're under eating, your diet is under eating just one of the nutrients important for this conversion, then that's your reason. But who knows, you know, if someone's eating lots of foods with selenium in them, adding more foods with selenium isn't the solution, but they might be low in a different mineral. They might be under eating carbohydrates. They might be under eating protein at very general levels, but they might have a great diet, but just for some reason, the foods they're eating aren't, you know, they're not getting some random, like they don't have enough zinc or something. They don't eat lamb, beef, or shellfish, but they say, oh, I eat protein from chicken and pork, and I eat fruit, and I eat. So they think they have a good diet in general because they're following good principles with enough carbohydrates, enough protein, but they might be really low in zinc, for example. That's just one example. So that's why it's almost impossible to say in a Facebook comment reply, increase your temperature by doing this, because everything that you should be doing for your health will increase your pulse and temperature to a good range. So this is more about liver health, because if your liver is sluggish by not having enough glycogen, not having enough carbohydrates, not having enough, you know, the right amount of minerals, not having enough protein, not having enough sleep, right? If the liver isn't in a good position, it won't be turning T4 to T3. So it's, just to clarify for the people listening, it's really not about the thyroid gland at the end of the day. It's,
I sent you that one thing that I was reading today, which is the first step in making cholesterol into steroid hormones is to convert it into a hormone called pregnenolone. This conversion takes place inside your cells in the mitochondria, which is the same place that your cells produce ATP, energy. To make the conversion from cholesterol to pregnenolone, you need certain nutrients like vitamin A, retinol, magnesium, and copper. If these are missing, cholesterol will build up as it cannot be converted. So high cholesterol could really be an indicator of a deficiency in certain vitamins and minerals. So I like that little statement because it keeps it super basic and understandable. And it also kind of shows us why gut health is important, because if you have leaky gut, or if you have malabsorption because of SIBO or undigested food, or you're a stressed eater, you don't eat well, whatever is compromising your gut health, this can cause malabsorption, which can lead to not absorbing the nutrients from your food, which can lead to this problem, right? Not just converting your cholesterol, but also, you know, a lot of other issues in the body. What about people who have too many hormones, right? They have really high estrogen, they have really high progesterone, they have really high testosterone. Usually those people tend to be younger, but, and they're just out of control. I mean, is that thyroid, does that have to do with, I guess I'm just answering my own question, but does that have to do with liver and thyroid as well, of course?
Yeah, absolutely. Because when you're not producing enough hormones as you should, and you're not, you know, your body is low in the pregnenolone and progesterone, the youth-associated hormones, then you start producing lots of hormones in other places, like the skin and the adrenal glands, for example. So PCOS is a great example, because PCOS is a situation with very low progesterone production from the ovaries, very high production of estrogen, and, you know, typically very low metabolic function. So they're very cold. They have low temperature, low pulse rate, probably high cholesterol, low pregnenolone, very low progesterone, like I said. So their body is saying, we have all this cortisol, and the cortisol is causing them insulin resistance by putting lots of fat in the blood, for example, and adrenaline, putting lots of fat in the blood, which is competing with the glucose. Your glucose in the blood stays high because there's free fat in the blood, free fatty acids, FFAs. Mm-hmm. So they have high cortisol, they have high adrenaline, they have very high estrogen, low progesterone. What's the body to do? Well, it needs to counteract the cortisol some way, and it needs to counteract the estrogen some way. So the adrenals start overproducing androgens in these girls. So you have a 19-year-old girl, and she's high DHEA, high testosterone. She's high androgens. What's she to do? Well, the root cause is she has low body temperature and pulse. And the root cause of that is, who knows? She could be low in copper, like you said, magnesium, vitamin A. She cannot be eating enough carbohydrates. Who knows? It's something that's causing her temperature to be low. This is causing her liver to not get rid of the estrogen, because you have to pee it out, poop it out, you know, one of those ways you got to get rid of the estrogen. And if your liver isn't functioning optimally, if you don't have a good temperature and pulse, you don't have a good thyroid hormone production and conversion, your estrogen is high, it's staying high. Your progesterone is staying low, because you need, your progesterone is being produced by the ovaries when you're 98.6 Fahrenheit. That's when it's really producing progesterone. So you have low progesterone, high estrogen. The adrenals are making up for this by producing lots of DHEA to protect you. But, oh, now you have lots of male hormones, and there's whiskers, and there's pimples, and there's acne, and all these things. So the solution isn't to lower the androgens like DHEA and testosterone. The solution is to get your metabolic rate up, your temperature and pulse rate up, get your estrogen detoxified, get your progesterone production up, and your adrenals will no longer need to be producing the DHEA, and the DHEA won't be there for the testosterone to be produced, and no more chin hair and no more pimples. So that's why Ray Pete often talks about how the best solution for PCOS, like the most direct approach, because there's lots of indirect things you could do, but the most direct approach would be literally taking thyroid or thyroid glandular, because that will increase the pulse and the temp, will help the liver detoxify estrogen, and will, you know, gut motility, so you're getting rid of the estrogen in the bowels. And it's going to make you start producing progesterone. And like I said, when your progesterone is up and your estrogen is down and your cortisol is down, your body won't need to produce the DHEA from the adrenals, and you'll have less testosterone because of that. Because testosterone comes from DHEA in women. So if a woman has whiskers or lots of pimples or PCOS, or they're PCOS-like, you got to get thyroid function up, and the most direct way is actually taking thyroid hormone. But obviously there's so many indirect ways to increase your core temperature in a good way. There's so many indirect ways to increase your T4 to T3 conversion. And that could be as simple as eating more protein, 80 to 100 grams, having double that in terms of carbs, maybe more, 200 grams of carbs, 250, the right carbs, fruit, honey, safe starches, whatever, the right fats, getting rid of the bad fats. You know, those are lots of indirect ways to do it. Have a diet high in minerals, right? Shellfish and chocolate and eggs and liver. So yeah, there's lots of indirect ways to increase your temperature and your metabolic function. And those indirect ways, if your temperature and pulse are going up, you're producing more progesterone, getting rid of more estrogen. Estrogen isn't stimulating the adrenals to produce DHEA and testosterone. So your androgens will go down, your estrogen will go down, your cortisol and adrenaline will go down, your progesterone will go up to where it should be because it's chronically low. If you have facial hair as a woman, obviously your progesterone is chronically low, and your estrogen is probably chronically high, and that's why the androgens are high. Mm. So PCOS is not an estrogen deficiency at all. PCOS, or, you know, even if a woman says, no, I don't have PCOS, but she has facial hair, then okay, you can call it whatever you want, but that's high estrogen causing high androgens, male, mm-hmm. from the adrenals. So
someone goes to the doctor and they get their thyroid panel done, full thyroid panel, and the doctor says, all right, let's put you on levothyroxine. Is that the one, the most common one?
Yeah, levothyroxine, thyroxine, synthyroid. These are all different names for T4. So T4 is the inactive thyroid hormone. It's the main hormone your thyroid gland produces. And this is a terrible advice, especially for women, because women just have more estrogen in the blood in general. And estrogen, yeah, and because women don't necessarily have more estrogen than men, especially in old age. An old man could have more estrogen than an old woman, right? Who knows? But usually younger women will have more estrogen than a younger man. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And estrogen is one of the main things preventing T4 from becoming T3. So if you have someone with low thyroid function, so high cholesterol, high TSH, low pulse and temp, they are already not converting enough T4 to T3. So giving them just T4, the inactive thyroid hormone, here's a person with clearly suboptimal liver function, clearly suboptimal metabolic function, because that's the whole reason they're on the T4. So I'm going to give them T4, forcing their liver to start converting T4 to T3. But that's just adding more work to the liver. And there's a reason the liver isn't converting the T4 you have into T3 in the first place, because it can't. It doesn't have enough energy. Likely you're under eating food or carbs in general, or maybe, like I said, minerals, whatever. So giving yourself more T4 isn't necessarily at all going to make your liver say, oh, great, thanks for the T4, I'll turn into T3. In fact, it'll probably cause your liver to increase lots of reverse T3, little r T3 on a blood test. And reverse T3 is the opposite of T3. It'll take the place of T3 as a break. So T3 is, you know, the gas, and reverse T3 is the break. And T4 can become either one. So an estrogen definitely promotes the reverse T3 route, the bad route. So,
and that's slowing things down further.
Yeah, it's making things worse. And on top of that, it can make things so much worse, because taking a high amount of T4, especially on an empty stomach, which is the advice given, which is terrible advice. You should never take your thyroid, you know, not medical advice, but you should never take your thyroid medication on an empty stomach. That's my opinion. That's Ray Peet's opinion. He's said it many times.
And why is this?
So he says there's absolutely no reasoning to tell people to take thyroid on an empty stomach, even though that's what every doctor and pharmacist says. Their reasoning is completely flawed, if they have any. And the whole point is, if your body senses a huge increase in thyroid hormone, first of all, it's going to shut down its own production for sure. And second, the liver is going to treat it as a toxin and just upregulate enzymes to get rid of thyroid. And we may disagree on this, but I think it's, to my understanding, it's the same deal with progesterone. If you give yourself too much progesterone, even though it's a great thing and your body likes it daily, the liver just gets good at getting rid of it by producing enzymes that degrade it. So it's good to, for progesterone at least, it's good to take maybe a week off, let's say a month, just so the liver doesn't make a lot of those enzymes. Mm-hmm. With thyroid's different. You don't have to take breaks from it, but you shouldn't give yourself super high amounts on an empty stomach going straight to the bloodstream. Your liver just going to say, we've got to get rid of this. It's a toxin. The solution is definitely taking your thyroid medication with food. Doesn't matter if it's thyroid glandular, like Armour or an over-the-counter option, or a synthetic. It should always be with food, because the food will help you slowly absorb the thyroid hormone. So let's say you are taking T4. I don't recommend taking T4 monotherapy or level thyroxine synthroid, but if you do, at least if you take it with food, it digests with the food. So you have a little bit of T4, a little bit of T4, a little bit of T4, instead of one big jump in your bloodstream.
I see.
You take it with food for sure. That's one point. The other point is, if someone's taking synthetic thyroid, I urge them to read Danny Roddy's short article on it called Demystifying Thyroid. I think you can find it at dannyroddy.substack or something like that. It'll be very easy to find if you just type in Demystifying Thyroid Danny Roddy on Google. And he explains all of this perfectly. If you're supplementing synthetic hormones, that's the, and Ray Peet talks a lot about it too. His two articles, I think one's called Thyroid Therapy Fraud, something like that. You can easily find it. RayPeet.com articles, search for thyroid therapy fraud. And another one's called TSH Pulse and Temperature. Two articles from Ray Peet, one from Danny Roddy. So having said that, from memory, you never want to take more than 10 micrograms of T3 at one time, and always with food. Because just like I said, if you take more than that, your liver will just start getting rid of it. So you don't want that, and you want it with food for sure. Never on an empty stomach. Even one microgram of T3 on an empty stomach could be, you know, harmful. It could be catastrophic. Because also, by the way, thyroid is supposed to increase your energy production. If you're not eating anything, so therefore empty stomach, how can you step on the gas pedal of your car, you know, which is your metabolism, without fuel, without any food? So it's a very bad idea.
Interesting.
Forget the liver thing. It's a bad idea to try to increase your metabolic rate with no fuel there. What's your liver going to do without glycogen and food to increase your metabolic rate? It's it's a very bad idea. And everyone out there that's taking thyroid on an empty stomach should stop, in my opinion.
But so say someone doesn't want to go back to their doctor to get a thyroid panel because the doctor said, you know, yeah, your thyroid is this, and we're going to put you on levothyroxine or Synthroid. And then you yourself know that, you know, your doctor's not listening to you about the fact that you feel like your temp and pulse are under, you're not, you know, you don't have a warm body, you know, you don't wake up hungry, you have all these adrenaline like reactions to everything, anxiety, heart palpitations when you wake up in the morning, all of that. And so you want to self-medicate, you want to do the like over-the-counter glandular yourself. What is your advice? You know, your personal opinion as to what Ray Pete says about this and all of these other people, to go ahead and start taking something like, you know, Thyromax or Thyrovans on your own. Would you have any warnings about it?
Yeah. So first, I just want to say, if someone is doing, just to wrap up the synthetic, if you're taking synthetic, I believe the goal is to take a little bit of T3 throughout the day, maybe with every meal. So maybe 3 to 5 micrograms with every meal of T3. And in the evening with your dinner, taking a combination of T3 and T4, because T4 stays in the system for a long time, but T3 has a much shorter half-life. Like I said, you could find more information by looking at the articles I mentioned, you know, before, but that's the synthetic route, T3, T4. If you're only taking T4, I mean, the best option I have for you is take it with food and take it with something anti-estrogenic, especially for a woman, like progesterone, because at least the progesterone will help the T4 turn to T3 instead of reverse T3. You know, vitamin E is another option. Even aspirin is another option. So there's mitigating factors you can do if you're just taking synthetic T4, but I don't recommend it because it's so risky. And I don't typically recommend doing the synthetic route anyway, because it's so difficult, because you have to do a little bit of T3. Some people do it every hour. Some people do it every meal. And, you know, if you have a T3 pill, you have to cut little pieces off of it to do that. So it's very involved. It's very tricky. But this is something that, for example, Danny Roddy, he knows how important it is for himself. So he does it. He takes the time, gets a gram scale, and sees exactly how much T3 he's taking. And he'll do it throughout the day. And, you know, he's very meticulous like that. And if you want to do that, great. But it's very cumbersome. And most of the people I talk to, I know, would not do that. So
why doesn't he just do the desiccated thyroid then?
You know, obviously I don't speak for Danny, but I believe I've heard Danny mention a couple times he doesn't take desiccated because he just doesn't trust any of the products, because you're hoping that there's no tampering with the desiccated products, because the desiccated products are basically, for people that don't know what that is, it's a thyroid gland from bovine, which is cow, or porcine, which is pig. And obviously, for lots of reasons, I think cow is preferable. But anyway, so let's say you have a good bovine desiccated thyroid. That's basically a thyroid gland of a cow put into a powder form. And in that powder of that thyroid gland, there will be a natural ratio of T4 to T3 with, you know, more T4 to T3, but at least they're both together. And that is what was originally used as thyroid therapy. It was desiccated, dried powder thyroid gland from animals. Danny has mentioned that, you know, he just doesn't trust these products because maybe they've taken the T3 out. It's possible. Obviously, you have to trust the company you're dealing with. It's very hard to know exactly how much T3 and T4 are in it, because I guess it depends on the animal. So I understand where Danny's coming from. It's so much harder to be precise when you're dealing with this natural desiccated thyroid gland. It's just a fact. It's hard to know exactly what you're getting. And he wants to know exactly what I'm getting. He knows I'm taking 3 micrograms of T3 with every meal, and he knows exactly what he's doing. But it's very cumbersome. You have to be very focused. It takes up your day, because you can't do a day trip and bring your little gram scale with you, right? So, you know, again, it would be great for you to talk with Danny about this. I'd love to hear what he's doing. But he is definitely a synthetic thyroid kind of guy. I think Ray Pete is also. And it's hard work. And I don't think, like I said, I don't think anyone I talk to would ever do it. And I don't want to do that myself.
So they take like Synthroid or Levo or something like that?
No, they take, because those are only T4, and they would never just take T4. But what they do is they take, throughout the day, they take a little bit of T3 only.
Which is it a prescribed T3?
I don't know where they get it from, but it's, I'm sure they don't go to a doctor for it,
right?
But it is synthetic. But when they take T4, it's a combination product always. I don't speak for those two, but I can guarantee they will never take T4 alone.
Okay.
They'll either take T3 alone or T4 and T3 together, but never T4 alone. And that's what Synthyroid is. It's T4.
Gotcha.
Alone.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, but having said that, that's the synthetic. Synthetic does have benefits over natural, like I talked about, but it's just so difficult to look at. It's definitely possible to do, but it's, like I said, it's confusing. It's cumbersome.
And you said, did you, I wrote this down well, because I didn't want to interrupt you, but you said high estrogen inhibits conversion of T4 to T3.
Oh yeah. One of the main things that's why women can have 10 times. I think it's I always hear different numbers, but it's like 4 to 10 times more thyroid disease than men because of the estrogen.
Yeah. You know, let's go ahead and start talking about estrogen and the fraud. That right there speaks volumes, because as you see in the estrogen dominance support group, how there's a lot of women who are very much married to their estrogen because their libido is better. They don't have vaginal atrophy anymore, vaginal dryness or whatever. So because those things are good and they feel like they're healthier than they've ever been, but they might be ignoring these other markers, which is that, okay, if you have a blood test that shows, or a Dutch test that shows that you have really low levels of estrogen, and your doctor says, hey, let's put you on estrogen, and it helps you with those things I mentioned. But meanwhile, that estrogen is blocking your conversion of T3 to T4, to T4 to T3. You are creating a huge, huge problem for yourself down the line.
You know, I'm just going to say now, I would never suggest someone to take exogenous estrogen ever for any reason, even vaginal atrophy. There's some people saying, okay, I get what you're saying, estrogen's harmful, but it's the only thing that works for vaginal atrophy, which is not true, because there are studies, and you can search it up. DHEA is perfect for vaginal atrophy. And why? Well, what causes atrophy most of the time? It's cortisol. Cortisol atrophies things. That's what it does. People with high cortisol, very thin lips, they have a really bad immune system because it atrophies their thymus gland, which is their immune cell producing gland. It makes, you know, thin skin, like I said. It tears down your muscles to take protein from the muscles to make glucose when you have low blood glucose. Cortisol causes atrophy. DHEA is our protector from cortisol. And further, DHEA can easily become estrogen. So using DHEA for a problem like vaginal atrophy makes so much more sense, because first of all, you're inhibiting that cortisol, so you're probably stopping the atrophy. DHEA itself is good for promoting, you know, the healthy growth of the lining, the cells, the cell walls. Even if you're in a situation where, no, the only thing that you need right now is more estrogen, which is logical, because estrogen is a growth hormone. And it does grow uterine lining. That's why endometriosis, which is lots of, you know, growth there, it's from too much estrogen. But anyway, let's say you had the opposite problem of endometriosis and you have this atrophy. Even if you needed estrogen, the DHEA can become estrogen. So there is, you know, I don't like to ever say never, but at least now I'm very confident that I would never tell someone to take estrogen in any form. Because I'll always find a better solution if they truly have really low estrogen. Taking pregnenolone, which is the mother steroid hormone, pregnenolone turns into progesterone DHEA, and it can easily become estrogen from there, right? So pregnenolone is a great way to fill in all the hormones that you're deficient in, especially when you get older. And Ray Peet writes in his book, I believe, Generative Energy. I think it's his newest one, which is still, I think, like 30 years old, but still it's, you know, the right. newest. I think he writes that, you know, young people will feel nothing from even very high doses of pregnenolone, but older people, even 100, you know, 50, 30 milligrams of pregnenolone, if they're like 70 or something, they'll feel drastic changes, because pregnenolone, DHEA, and progesterone are high in youthful people. And giving yourself exogenous pregnenolone is very, very safe. And it can fill in where you're needing, but also you can give yourself the actual pregnenolone you you need when you're older, or even when you're young and you have bad hormone production.
Mm-hmm.
But so that just one example. If someone needs more estrogen, pregnenolone is an option. DHEA is an option. Just like I said, vaginal atrophy, use DHEA. Even if you do need estrogen, it'll become estrogen for you. There's no need to take the estrogen.
My question, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, is how can we ensure that we do the things, that we do the right things with our hormones? You know, because there is a concern about converting DHEA to estrogen when you don't need the estrogen. Or in my case, in many women's cases, taking something like testosterone and having it convert to estrogen. You know, I'm so curious, and I know that it's going to come down to the thyroid again and the nutrient deficiencies again, because it would seem that the default pathways are the more unhealthy pathways. It's almost like I think Kate Deering said this. I forget who said this. It's almost like you're reverting to use your generator on your house instead of using the power source to your house. Like you're always operating on your backup generator, and defaulting to use these unhealthy pathways seems like a result of using your backup generator, of having low metabolic state.
Yeah, well, you know, there's obvious reasons for that. And, you know, if people insist on using backup pathways to do things like produce energy, then they are insisting that their body does backup pathways with their hormones. You know, that's what you do. So I like your analogy of, you know, you're using the generator to make energy in your house other than just actually using the electricity. So if you do that, you actually use the generator instead of the actual electricity, then you're going to have to use, you know, coal to make your, or wood to make your fire instead of using a stove. I mean,
yeah.
You say, oh, I wish I could use my stove, but you're choosing not to use, you know, the right things in your house to have power, fire and water and all this. That you're choosing to go to the well to get water than using the faucet. That's what you're choosing to do.
Yeah.
And you have to stop choosing to do that. And how are some ways that people choose? Well, they go on low carb diets. You stop eating carbohydrates. So now you're forcing your body to produce carbohydrates. And you say, I'm so smart because my body produces carbs. And that means that they're optional. That is one way of looking at it. And I think it's a very incorrect way of looking at it. Carbs are so important. You need them so bad that even if you don't eat them, your body will break you down to make them. That doesn't tell me that they're optional. How is that the conclusion that you can make from that? So carbs are so important that they'll make, I will break down my body to make them. That means they're optional. No. So the conclusion you should make is I better be eating carbohydrates so my body doesn't break itself down and doesn't go to, you know, plan B. It stays in plan A. Use glucose for energy.
That's such a good analogy and great way of saying it, because our body does that with a lot of things. Like I call it the rob Peter to pay Paul method. Like our body can do it. It robbed Peter to pay Paul to do it. But it's kind of like when you are in bone loss, you know, or you have really poor digestion, you don't have enough hydrochloric acid, your body has these backup mechanisms. Like it will go into the bones to retrieve minerals to buffer the acidity in a putrefying gut. And that is amazing, right? That's amazing. But it's also compromising your bone health to do it. And so same thing, that's an awesome way of saying it, the glucose, but also hormones. Like you do have backup methods of making estrogen and making, supplying yourself with the means that you need to stay alive, to survive. But does that mean that it's a good thing? It does not necessarily mean that.
Yeah, no, not at all. Because I mean, no one wants high stress hormones all the time. No one wants to have lots of aldosterone, cortisol, adrenaline. But like, for example, if you have enough progesterone, you won't need any of those. Progesterone can do whatever any other hormone can do. You don't need aldosterone if you have progesterone, lots of it. You don't need cortisol if you have lots of progesterone. You don't need 40 times the amount of adrenaline as a normal person has, unless if you have good T3, you have lots of your T4 is turning into T3 optimally. It's not sluggish. Your liver is doing well. You don't need 40 times the amount of adrenaline. If you have low thyroid hormone production, your body's not going to just, at least not right away, not going to just let you be depressed with no energy sitting, can't even get up from the bed or whatever. It's going to increase adrenaline, and it's going to increase it and increase and increase it 40 times the amount that you should be producing. So
wow,
you don't need that much adrenaline if you have your T4 turning into T3. You don't need that. You don't need any aldosterone, but really, if you have progesterone, for example, and it's fine to have a little aldosterone, it's fine to have some cortisol, it's fine to have adrenaline, it is fine, but you shouldn't ask them for too much. Like I said with the well, if sometimes, the water from your tap, you can't use it from, 2 to 3 in the afternoon for some reason. Okay, you can go use the well for that hour of the day. That's fine. You're using the well a little bit. But if you're never using the tap in your home and you're always using the well, you're happy the well's there, but you don't want to have to go outside and get water from a well when you can get it from your faucet, right? So, you're happy that the well's there, but you don't want to use it. So, and that's what I mean. Like, if you're in a good state of health, and I'm going to keep repeating it, you're eating enough protein, the right protein, you're eating enough carbs, the right carbs, you're eating enough fat, the right fat, and you're getting enough minerals. You're not just eating you're not just having a bunch of white rice which has really no nutrients and say, oh, I had enough carbs. Well, if you ate fruit, you would be getting lots of minerals like potassium. If you eat tomatoes and strawberries, you're getting vitamin C, you're getting potassium. White rice is a fine carbohydrate source, but it's basically just glucose. It's just starch. Yeah, if you're eating enough food, you're eating enough nutrients by eating good foods, fruits and meats and eggs and shellfish and blah, blah, blah. Your cholesterol is turning into pregnenolone, DHA, and progesterone. A lot of it's staying that way. You have lots of pregnenolone. You feel great. You're youthful. Lots of DHA, but not too much, right? Like a girl will have too much DHA if she has too much estrogen. But obviously that's a bad case, and no one should take more DHEA if they have PCOS. But the DHEA is not your problem. The problem is the estrogen. But anyway, normal people, normal health, high DHEA is great. Or, high normal DHEA. Lots of progesterone is great for men and women, but mostly women, obviously. You want these here, and then your stress hormones will only come up a little bit when they need to. Cortisol, aldosterone, adrenaline, whatever. Parathyroid hormone, you want it low. Prolactin, you want it low. You don't want it to be, chronically high. You don't want it to be elevated like that. You'll be happy the parathyroid hormone's there when you need calcium, but it'd be better to just have no parathyroid hormone and just eat the calcium from dairy, for example. So, yeah, that's really where we want to go. And, yeah, I guess this kind of relates to what we were just talking about, how you never want estrogen, but.
Yeah, well, that's it's all part of the same thing. So tell me about estrogen fraud, the fraud that's been perpetrated on women and humanity regarding estrogen.
So first I want to start with some obvious ones. So people say, oh, estrogen's good for the bones. Totally not true. Estrogen is one of the main drivers of osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, arthritis in general. Estrogen is not good for bone growth or bone health, and estrogen promotes PTH, parathyroid hormone, and prolactin a lot. And prolactin and parathyroid hormone are the two direct hormones causing the bone loss. So no, estrogen is not good for the bones. And one of the best things for the bones, first of all, is lowering parathyroid hormone, lowering prolactin, but also DHEA. So if all your DHEA is becoming estrogen because you're sick and stressed, because that's what happens, by the way, this is part of the reason you can never be low in estrogen. Every cell in the body can produce it. And you can take estrogen can vampire things. That's why I call the aromatase enzyme the vampire enzyme, because it will turn other hormones into estrogen. So it literally will.
And what do you think the biochemical function of that? Why would the body do that if it doesn't need it?
Georgie would say it's our, primal hormone. Estrogen's like a first hormone. It's a stupid without a purpose growth hormone is. And he said this in your episode. I was just listening to it again because Georgie's so great. And he was saying, you know, you'll revert to estrogen, your primordial, I think, hormone. It doesn't look like anything, doesn't have any shape or function, but it's growing, you know, just like cancer. That's what cancer is. It's just
right. Just
cells are growing.
Causes cells liver. To divide and grow.
Yeah. And they're not liver cells. They're these, you know, liver cancer isn't like a bigger liver. It's a growth on your liver that is not your liver, and it doesn't resemble a liver at all. It's a giant gross mass of cells. And that's thanked estrogen for that. That's what estrogen is. So it's our like, it's a prehistoric hormone, basically. Is a way of
it is quite old, but so is progesterone. Progesterone is really, really old. Also. So
progesterone is a pro-differentiating hormone. It gives cells a purpose. So anyway, estrogen is just, it's so easy to make estrogen because it's a stress hormone and it produces anytime you're stressed. And stress means you didn't eat enough, there's stress, and now estrogen is produced. So it's a vampire because it will take DHEA or, you know, some androstenedione or something, pick a hormone, and it will turn that hormone into estrogen and will make it. Or I guess vampires, I guess it's more like a zombie, I guess, you know, I think, yeah, it's more right. like a zombie. It's like tag, but, you know, the version where if you're it and you touch someone, you're both it.
Right.
It's like, that's what estrogen is.
It's a zombie, yeah.
It's more a zombie than a vampire.
But. Yeah, because vampires, there's something more elegant about vampires. Vampires are more like parasitic or something. But
It's a stupid, ugly, gross
brains.
But brains. But anyway, DHA, for just to stay on osteoporosis, DHA is like the best thing for osteoporosis, and it's, you know, if you have lots of estrogen, that means, well, sorry, your DHA is becoming estrogen. So estrogen promotes prolactin, one of the main hormones for destroying your bones, causing brittle bones. And you know what's good for the bones? It's progesterone and testosterone. So obviously estrogen is the opposite of those. I think technically I'd call aldosterone the opposite of progesterone, actually, which might come as a, you know, you'd think estrogen, progesterone do their dance, but anyway, that's another story. But obviously, estrogen and progesterone are very different. And when estrogen's super high relative to progesterone, then you have high estrogen. So high progesterone, good for your bones. High testosterone, good for your bones. High estrogen, it's terrible for your bones. So don't let anyone, like the bodybuilders, tell you, and I say bodybuilders because it's weird. They're the ones that's, because you know why? They take aromatase inhibitors, which lowers estrogen. And they're like, oh, this is so bad for your bones. And, you know, I guarantee it's not because estrogen is good for the bones. There must be some other reason there. We don't have to get into that specifically. I'm sure George, you would have a lot to say about that. Mm-hmm. But the point is, estrogen is not good for your bones. If you have osteoporosis, that doesn't mean you have estrogen deficiency. You probably have too much. Even if it's low in the blood, like I said, can be very high in the tissue, and the more you age, the more estrogen will be stored in the tissue. Blood is an ovary producing, you know, the blood shows you what your ovaries are producing. Mm-hmm. Just because you're not producing a lot of estrogen in the ovaries doesn't mean all your cells are making a bunch of estrogen. So,
well, I mean, that it seems like it goes that way with a lot of things, like, you know, with iron, with hormones, including thyroid. It's like, just because it's not showing up in the blood does not mean that levels are low. It means either that it's, you know, locked up in tissues, or it's in the cell where it should be, or kind of like Morley talks about ferritin. You know, he's like, don't ever use ferritin as a marker for good iron levels, because ferritin in the blood is not where it's supposed to be. So you're chasing after a red herring if you're looking at, oh, my ferritin is too low. Yeah. And so that seems to go with a lot of things, which is a bummer, because it almost makes it seem like blood labs are just like, well, like we said, it's just a piece to the puzzle.
Yeah, I think the blood labs are good for pituitary hormones. So prolactin and TSH are pituitary hormones. So it's an LH and FSH, obviously, luteinizing hormone, follicular follicle stimulating hormone. You know, it's good for pituitary hormones. I don't think we're storing TSH, for example, right? It's because pituitary is like a messenger. The pituitary makes messenger hormones, like the thyroid stimulating hormone. Like it's a message, stimulate the thyroid. It's not like we have a need for TSH other than telling our thyroid to produce more T4. So we wouldn't be storing it, for example. So blood tests are really good for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But for estrogen, definitely not, especially because people are like, oh, my E2 was low. you have other forms of estrogen, and those forms, the weaker forms, can like rapidly turn into the more harmful forms. So
yeah, I mean, that's the dangers of blood labs, and not just blood labs, but even the Dutch, you know, oh, my estrogen is low, I better take estrogen. My DHEA is low, I better take DHEA.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. Sorry, go on.
That's it. Yeah, just taking things when you don't necessarily need to, yeah. Just because your lab said so.
Especially the Dutch. Like, I have a client who has low hormones across the board on the Dutch, and that doesn't mean she has low hormones necessarily. That could mean that her liver is very in need of energy, because a hormone will only show up in your urine if you're
excreting it.
Yeah, if your liver glucuronidated it, it made it water soluble to go into the urine, and the kidneys are involved. So if you come back and say, wow, every hormone was low, that could be a sign of low hormones. It could be a sign of you're not excreting them at all, and their estrogen is staying in your tissue. So yeah, so that's why it's really hard, because when people talk to me and they say, oh, blood and Dutch estrogen was low, for example, like that really tells me not a lot, especially if they have so many high estrogen symptoms.
Right. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the Dutch lab when it shows that someone with almost no hormones can favor like the 1608H pathway. That to me just is so strange, because why would that show up in that percentage, yeah, if you're not excreting anything? But I guess from what you are excreting,
yeah,
which is still weird. But anyway.
I would just say, yeah, the Dutch, you know, it works with what it has, and you know, from the little that is excreted, it might say, see, this is what we found.
Right.
Well, like I said, if your liver is, if you're under eating, your liver is not focused on detoxifying estrogen by making it water soluble to get into the urine. That's definitely not happening. And this other woman, I won't say her name, obviously, but she had dry bowel movements. And that means low bile. And bile is how we excrete hormones like estrogen in the bowels. So if you have really low estrogen on a Dutch, that means you're not peeing out a lot. If you have really dry bowel movements, that means there's nothing really, there's no hormones there. It's bile is what makes dry, means there's no bile, and bile is what would contain the estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be excreting estrogen in the bowel, but it comes out dry because it's sitting there too long, maybe you're constipated, and it gets reabsorbed, and that estrogen's even more harmful than when you originally excreted in the bowel. So dry
points right back to what you said, what we were talking about, which is low metabolic rate, low metabolic function.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's another reason why. So I have so many reasons for never suggesting estrogen. First of all, the tests that people use to say they need estrogen they shouldn't be used for that purpose. The Dutch and blood tests, you know, even stool tests, they shouldn't be used to say this person has low estrogen, because just so many things could be causing estrogen to be low, especially if all the hormones are low across the board on the Dutch. Well, that's more a liver issue than a low hormone issue, right? Maybe. But I will say some people could have low hormones because they have very low cholesterol. It's definitely possible to have very low cholesterol while not being on a statin. And why is this important? Well, like we said so many times, you need cholesterol to make every steroid hormone. That's the first step. And if you, for some reason, have super low cholesterol, maybe you're like, you're not eating enough. That can be enough right there. Maybe you're eating so much fiber, you're only eating lettuce and beans all day. That'll lower cholesterol in a bad way. I like utilizing cortisol, not lowering it. Utilizing it obviously lowers high cholesterol because you're turning it into things, but I don't want to just take cholesterol and get rid of it. And low, you know, high fiber does that. polyunsaturated fats do that in a bad way. They lower cholesterol in a bad way. Statins just stop the liver from producing cholesterol, which I hope by now it's obvious why that's a terrible thing, because you need cholesterol to produce your hormones, which make you a man or a woman and make you youthful and energized. Like, if you lower your cholesterol via statin drug, where are you going to make pregnenolone from? And, you know, testosterone and progesterone. Yeah. Anyway, but someone could have really low cholesterol for a number of reasons, maybe PUFA, maybe fiber, maybe not eating enough, lots of reasons. If they have low cholesterol, they're not producing pregnenolone, DHA, progesterone. And a lot of estrogen comes by zombieing the other hormone. So maybe estrogen's low because you have low hormone production in general. But then, obviously, at least for me, the solution isn't, oh, you actually are lower in estrogen, let's give you estrogen. No. If you're low estrogen because you're not producing hormones in general, you got to start producing hormones in general. And then if a side effect of that is more estrogen, that's fine, because you didn't give yourself estrogen. You made more estrogen by producing more pregnenolone, DHA, like you should.
Right.
So I will always come up with an excuse to not give someone estrogen, even if very rare they had low estrogen. It's the solution isn't to give yourself estrogen, it's to start producing hormones again. So if someone takes a blood test and their cholesterol is very low, you got to do stuff to increase that cholesterol. Maybe eat more is the first step. Eat less beans and leaves and stuff like that. I guess that would be a first. Definitely don't take fish oil in general. Never take fish oil. So yeah, if someone has low cholesterol, okay, maybe they have low estrogen, maybe, but they're not going to feel better when they take estrogen. That's not the solution.
You know, these are shortcuts, you know, like I could have easily have stayed right around the time that I met you. I could have stayed on my bulletproof intermittent fasting routine, and I could have lost lots of weight, and I did, and go, you know, go to Florida in a month or in a couple of weeks and just been in my bathing suit and been super happy and been like, yeah, I'm doing such a good job with my health. But meanwhile, having these other issues, that are still lingering, and you know, this adrenaline state that I am in, and you know, like you were talking about with the cortisol wearing away tissues, thinning your lips, you know, thinning your skin. I mean, that's been me my whole life. But like, as you get older, it just gets so much worse. And so, you know, I could keep going down that road, but be like, hey, at least my whatever, at least I look good in a bathing suit. But it's the harder road to say, okay, I'm going to retract all of that. I'm going to stop doing all that stuff. I'm going to take a break from the hormones, and I'm going to start over from the metabolic basics. That'd be a good name for something, the metabolic basics. To start from the basics, which is what you do in your coaching process, which I love. And I'm wanting to send you people, because I don't do that. I just give loads of information to people and help them sift through it. I don't go down to this sort of like, let me hold your hand and show you, you know, did you take your pulse today? What did you eat today? What's your food diary? Mm-hmm. And breaking things down to such basic levels and almost starting over again. Because if you're suffering from things like PCOS or, you know, infertility or whatever, low T even, just for a guy, let's say, if you're suffering from these things and panic attacks, anxiety, all this stuff, like you have to like address these things, because they will exponentially get worse as you age until you have dementia, until you are breaking bones, until you're breaking your hip, you know, and having an impossible time recovering from injuries and things like that, which is just age, right? But it's not just age. Like, we can go into age gracefully if we, I think, are metabolically functioning well.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with everything. And that's a good segue because, well, first of all, I forgot to mention osteoporosis is predominantly woman disease. Mm-hmm. Women get it more than men. And there's a reason for that. And it's not because, you know, how does that make any sense? Estrogen's good for the bones. Women have more estrogen, and women are the ones that get osteoporosis.
Right.
Where does that make any sense? But, and people will, and then I obviously, there'll be some smart, why, you know, there'll be some people that'll come back and say, oh, well, Obviously, women get osteoporosis after menopause because after menopause, they stop producing estrogen and estrogen was protecting their bones. Well, you almost got it if you switch estrogen with progesterone. Because people need to realize menopause is not a estrogen deficient state. Like, it's quite the opposite, actually. It's menopause happens, you're producing less hormones from the ovaries, which means you're producing way less progesterone, but estrogen is still being produced all these other places. So menopause is not a estrogen deficient state, not at all. It is definitely a progesterone deficient state, and that's why doing what you can to increase your progesterone production, which includes taking, it can include taking bioidentical progesterone dissolved in vitamin E. It could include that, doesn't have to include that. Progesterone is what you want to increase to protect. Like, all these diseases that women get after menopause can be prevented by making sure you're producing lots of progesterone and not overproducing estrogen. So the medical system loves to kill women by saying, you're 14 years old, let's get you on estrogen via birth control. And then, oh, you're menopause, let's get you on hormone replacement therapy, which is sometimes, a lot of times, just estrogen. And then, sorry, woman, you got breast cancer. That's because of your genes. So these women are getting breast cancer, osteoporosis, all the dementias.
I mean, how about gallbladder? Gallbladder removal.
Gallbladder. Women get gallbladder issues more than men, for sure. Strokes is a woman thing, and it's very involved.
Heart disease.
Estrogen clots blood, and vitamin E is a blood thinner because vitamin E is a estrogen antagonist. Vitamin E helps thin the blood by stopping estrogen from overclotting it. So that's great. It's not like vitamin E is warfarin or something. Vitamin E is just saying estrogen is causing you to clot a lot. And that, what's her name? Justin Bieber's wife blamed her stroke on the birth control pill. And, you know, obviously there's probably another reason why this young girl got a stroke in her brain, but she's not wrong that the birth control can definitely contribute to that, because birth control is estrogen. Estrogen clots blood. Yeah. Blood clot in your brain is a stroke. So
I think
she's wrong. It definitely played a role.
It definitely played a role, and it doesn't help if you're, you know, getting the jab as well, when we know that contributes to clotting as well.
And that's a part of the reason aspirin helps thin blood. Part of the reason, not the whole reason, but aspirin is very similar to vitamin E, and aspirin is an aromatase inhibitor. It lowers estrogen. So if someone's
we talked about this before, but what is the highest dosage, like, for the average person to be taking of aspirin?
If I knew someone with colon cancer and they said, you know, I want your help, I'd probably want them in the 3 to 6 gram range.
Wow.
So 6,000 milligrams, potentially. There'd be a number of other things, too. About the same dosage of niacinamide, not niacin, 3 to 6 grams as well.
What about for, like, these women who are having, you know, who, like, need aromatase inhibitors, and women who are having chin hairs and, you know, dealing with all of those things?
Yeah, every fat-soluble vitamin is an aromatase inhibitor. Vitamin E is the strongest of them. So it's just safer to do vitamin E. Not that aspirin is not safe, but first of all, you get a lot of people complaining saying, you know, there's never any room for any pharmaceuticals. And you know what? I can respect that. And if someone doesn't want aspirin because it's technically a drug, that's fine. You know, aspirin is very similar to vitamin E. Just take vitamin E then. It's the natural version in some senses, at least in some ways. But there's so many natural aromatase inhibitors, like white button mushrooms are great. Mm-hmm. Eating the raw carrot salad doesn't, you know, inhibit aromatase, but it removes estrogen from the bowels, which is probably even more important than inhibiting aromatase. You want to get rid of the estrogen that you've detoxified. So the raw carrot salad, which is grated raw carrots with olive oil or coconut oil, vinegar, and salt. And people always say, oh, do I have to add those stuff? Well, yeah, there's a synergy. It's not just, you know, all of those together are worth more together. It's not, you know, it's worth way more than the sum of their uses to their value. So yes, there's definitely a synergy when you combine all of them. So the rock-haired salad's great. Boiled white bun mushrooms are so great, especially because they are an aromatase inhibitor, on top of their many other benefits. Stinging nettle root is a herb. Stinging nettle leaf tea is another good aromatase inhibitor that's literally just a drink. So it's not even a supplement. It's just a drink. Vitamin E, like I said, vitamin K2. Eating enough vitamin A, especially vitamin A is an anti-estrogen for the skin. So any estrogen skin issue, like eczema or pimples or, you know, facial hair, if you want anti-estrogens for the skin, it's vitamin A. And when you have too much estrogen on the skin can't, doesn't have enough energy to do what it should. So then you can have a keratin buildup, like keratosis pilaris, which is KP or chicken skin. And people say they eat more vitamin A and the KP goes away. Well, that's because the vitamin A is directly lowering estrogen on the skin, allowing the skin to become skin cells and not overproduce keratin, because keratin is easy to produce. So they start overproducing keratin when there's too much estrogen on the skin. Mm. Another way is called leukoplamia, I think. It's when you have too much cell growth on the inside of your cheeks. So it's these people are always biting their cheeks by accident because there's too much cell growth. That is completely rectified with vitamin A. Your cheeks are producing too much skin, almost like a cancer, to be honest. But it's not a cancer, obviously. But and vitamin
it's like
A
is like endometriosis. Like
exactly. Oh yeah. You know what? It's the same. It's just the same type of thing. It's actually the same thing. So vitamin A is, you know, eat your vitamin A, eat your liver for aromatase inhibiting. Take a vitamin E supplement. Unique E is my choice. And if you want, there's also aspirin, but
Did you say, or A?
Unique E for vitamin E. Vitamin A you should eat from food.
Yeah,
and vitamin E, I like Unique E on iHerb. It's pretty cheap and good quality. But anyway, you mentioned Alzheimer's. And that's another huge fraud, because people say estrogen's good for your brain, and people will even give estrogen to women that have like one of the dementias or Alzheimer's, right, or ALS even. Mm-hmm. And estrogen is one of, I'd say, the main causes of all of those, especially Alzheimer's. One of the treatments that I would suggest for a dementia Alzheimer patient would be to increase allopregnanolone. And there are clinical trials and studies of people actually being given allopregnanolone as a hormone, which is a neurosteroid. And it is showing huge promise in reversing the pathology. It's fantastic.
Really?
But allopregnanolone, this is my approach. And people might be like confused about the hormones and saying they don't want to mess with hormones. And I understand that, but you've probably taken a hormone in your life, listener, because first of all, if you've taken Flonase, that's basically cortisol in your nose.
Yeah, so many people have taken cortisol and cortisone.
Yeah, cortisone, cortisol, you know, cortisone will turn into cortisol. So Flonase is a corticosteroid. Asthma inhalers, like a corticosteroid bronchio, you know. So if you have asthma, you've probably taken cortisol. Well, that's a hormone right there. You can go to do you have Shopper Drug Mart in? I think that's Canadian. Okay, you go to your drugstore, whatever it is. You can buy melatonin. That's a hormone. So I think hormone is kind of like a dirty word, but it doesn't have to be, because if you're on birth control, you're taking hormones. You're taking estrogen or a progestin, progestins are more similar to testosterone than progesterone. And they're way more similar to estrogen than progesterone. So progestins... are by no means progesterone, but anyway, it's still a hormone. So if you've taken birth control, you've taken a hormone. If you've taken melatonin to go to sleep, some people take melatonin every day. They're taking a hormone every day. If you take Flonase or inhaled corticosteroid. So my point is, hormone doesn't have to be a dirty word. You've probably taken lots of hormones before. Having said that, in my opinion, and this is backed up by a lot of, you know, research, it's not just my opinion, the safest hormones are the hormones closest to cholesterol. So for the millionth time, you have cholesterol, then pregnenolone. That's step one. Step two is DHA and progesterone. Anything after that step is a specialized hormone, and they're very tightly regulated. I always opt if someone's going to deal with hormones, and they can be very helpful, especially in old age with these diseases. Like if you have Alzheimer's, you don't want to mess around with like stinging nettle root. Like you want something that's going to work. And
that's more direct.
It's more direct. So it's always safer to deal with pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, the youth associated hormones, the general hormones. They're not very specialized. Like I said, progesterone can take on the role of basically any hormone. It has aldosterone-like effects, for example. So you don't, it's not that progesterone will turn into aldosterone. It can, it does. But if you have large progesterone, you won't even need the aldosterone because the progesterone can do what the aldosterone is doing with the sodium regulation, for example. So progesterone, DHA, pregnenolone, very safe, far safer than the birth control pill estrogen, which even 12-year-old girls are on now nowadays. Far safer than an inhaled corticosteroid, far safer than melatonin pills even. So if you're scared of hormones, you shouldn't be scared of pregnenolone, definitely. Progesterone, you could be a little scared if you're a guy, you don't use too much. It is more of a woman hormone, that's for sure, but males can use it. Just be, you have to learn a little bit about these things before you use them, obviously. So don't go crazy with progesterone if you're a male or female. And then DHA has its issues too. The higher you are, so pregnenolone is literally the highest you can go unless you supplement cholesterol, which people can do. I don't recommend it though. Pregnenolone is super safe. So anyway, my point there is saying I don't think allopregnenolone is unsafe, but it is a very specialized, very downstream neurosteroid. So what's the safest way to increase allopregnenolone? Well, first of all, you can take pregnenolone. Very safe, like I said, it's the first step after cholesterol. Pregnenolone, a lot of it will turn into progesterone. A lot of it will turn into allopregnenolone. There you go. Now you've already increased allopregnenolone in your brain. Pregnenolone itself is beneficial for the brain in Alzheimer's. Progesterone itself is very protective for the brain in Alzheimer's and allopregnenolone. So if you think about a chain, all three of them are fantastic for the brain, fantastic for helping to reverse and prevent Alzheimer's or dementia. So I would say take pregnenolone if you know like an aunt or someone who has dementia. Pregnenolone is so safe. You can give her pregnenolone. So first of all, pregnenolone will help, and a lot of it will turn into progesterone, and then allopregnenolone. Give her progesterone dissolved in vitamin E on the gums, go straight to the brain. Because the progesterone itself is helpful, and a lot of it will turn to allopregnenolone. If someone's very far gone, you can even give allopregnenolone too. But if you're giving someone pregnenolone and progesterone, I don't think you have to worry about the allopregnenolone. A lot of it's going to convert to allopregnenolone. The progesterone is beneficial itself. Pregnenolone is beneficial itself. Anyway, all three of those on that chain are very safe. And they're very beneficial to the brain. And they're really beneficial partly, especially progesterone, because it will help counteract the estrogen that's causing a lot of the dementia issues. Estrogen will cause the cells of the brain to like, the proteins of the brain to like fold the wrong way. Like there's so many, technical things to go into it, but estrogen is bad for the brain. It's excitotoxic. It's toxic to the brain. It has similar effects to cocaine on the brain, and it actually has similar effects to cocaine. People say sugar has similar effects to cocaine. It doesn't. Not compared to estrogen. Estrogen is like a cocaine, excitotoxic. It's excitatory to the brain, and it's toxic. It kills the brain cells. And estrogen makes women talk. It can make your brain feel buzzy, and you talk really fast, and you feel energetic. So a lot of women can feel better because they have energy. But it's a really bad type of energy, and one of the things with estrogen is I don't know the name of the study, but they even did clinical stuff, and people with higher estrogen, they would say way more words in a given time period than a low estrogen person, but like the meaning of what they were saying was way less. So
right,
it was a lot of talking, and there wasn't really substance. And that's one of the things that estrogen can make you feel good. It's like, well, I'm so sharp and witty, I'm talking so much.
You're right. Like,
it's excitotoxic, and it's one of the main reasons it's so bad for dementia and Alzheimer's. And like I said, Alzheimer's, I don't think I actually said this, but Alzheimer's, I think 2/3 of Alzheimer's patients are women. So obviously it's way more, I don't even know a single male with Alzheimer's, I think. And I know multiple women.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
With it. So anyway, that's, estrogen is harmful for Alzheimer's. And if you want to protect your brain, especially as you're getting older, 60s, 70s, you know, or you know a person that already has it, like an aunt or whatever, a family friend, pregnenolone, progesterone are protective. Lowering estrogen any way you can is protective. And another reason estrogen causes dementias is estrogen promotes the storage of iron in tissues. And iron in the brain is very bad for the brain. It's bad for it increases dementia. So mm-hmm. you get estrogen and iron together, and estrogen promotes the retention of iron. And you get polyunsaturated fats together. These are the main causes of Alzheimer's. And also, it's people call it type 3 diabetes, and that's because if your brain can't oxidize glucose well enough, it can't utilize glucose well, then you have issues. So that's why, and I'll just add this in, it has nothing to do with estrogen, but vitamin B1 and methylene blue, because they help you oxidize glucose, they've both been shown to be extremely therapeutic for Alzheimer's and dementias, and niacinamide, because all three of those things help you to start oxidizing glucose. So they're good for diabetes proper mm-hmm. and also Alzheimer's diabetes type 3, because you give yourself niacinamide, B1, methylene blue, and you're eating carbohydrates, obviously, because you can't oxidize glucose well if you're not eating glucose. So you're eating glucose via fruit and honey, whatever, potatoes, and you take B1, B3, niacinamide, not niacin, and methylene blue. Well, that's a great combination there. You add in progesterone, pregnenolone, and maybe vitamin E to lower estrogen even more, and, you know, go on a low iron diet. And mm-hmm. that's a really therapeutic thing for dementia. And, you know, I would search for the viewer, I would search in the word Alzheimer's into heydude.me, and you could find lots of blog posts on this, and you can look at the different titles. And he has one on B1, thiamine, he has one on methylene blue. You can look at all of them, and they're allopregnanolone. He has a blog post on that. You can look at all these. And anyway, we can stop talking about that. But the point is, people say estrogen's good for the bones and the brain. It's terrible for both. So mm-hmm. that's two major fraud.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like wrapping our heads around it and taking and trusting, you know, this information, because that's the hardest part, is hearing the opposite. You know, we hear the opposite. And so it's really difficult. It's like the same concept behind taking iron and all of that, you know, but it's really good info. And do you have anything else to add or say before we wrap it up?
Yeah, sure. So I'll just quickly say, also, people will say that progesterone must be making them feel bad, because they'll erroneously assume that the luteal phase is the progesterone dominant phase and the follicular phase is the estrogen dominant phase. And if they feel bad during the luteal, which is the time right before you start menstruating, so the end of the cycle, they'll say that they feel the worst then, which to them means, oh, I feel bad when progesterone's high, so progesterone's making me feel bad. But
yeah,
that's not true. The follicular phase, the follicular phase is a phase with low hormone need in general. Mm-hmm. So if you're having a hard time producing hormones like progesterone, you'll feel better in the follicular phase, because your need for, let's just say, progesterone is less. Mm-hmm. The luteal phase is a phase where your need for progesterone is very high. Mm-hmm. So if you feel really bad, that means that you're not producing enough progesterone. So if you're not producing enough progesterone in the luteal phase, you'll feel terrible, because that's when you need progesterone. Mm-hmm. You know, you need it a lot right after ovulation. You need a lot right before menstruation. You need it a lot the whole luteal phase. And if you're not producing progesterone, you'll feel bad. So that's another misconception that, oh, I feel bad during progesterone phase. That's because you're not producing progesterone enough. Likely it's not because you know, progesterone is making you feel bad. So right. that's another thing. And one quick thing, we already talked about PCOS, so I won't go back into it, but a lot of people say they have PCOS, so that means they must have low estrogen, because, you know, how can I have estrogen if I have facial hair? But we already talked about it, high estrogen, low progesterone causes the adrenals to produce male hormones. That's why you have facial hair and acne and high androgen. So the estrogen is high in PCOS. It's not low. So I think that's the main fraud things I want to talk about. It's estrogen, not good for the brain, not good for the bones. It's not low in PCOS. Progesterone is not high in the luteal phase in someone that's having a bad luteal phase.
I'll add to that. Yeah. That even when hormones are meant to be the absolute lowest, you still have to have the balance of the two, of the progesterone and the estrogen, opposing one another. Because if you don't, that's when estrogen can surge at times that it's not supposed to. And that thus estrogen dominance, right? So it doesn't even have to be at a time when hormones are meant to be high at all. It can be at the lowest point of hormone production. And still, if there isn't that balance of the two, you can have an estrogenic reaction, or yeah, you can have really bad symptoms. I mean, I've heard people have symptoms all month long. You know, they can have symptoms throughout their entire cycle. And so just wanted to add to that.
Yeah. And also, you know, this isn't necessarily fraud, because by fraud, I meant things that people say estrogen's good for, but it's actually the opposite. But I just want to add that estrogen is harmful for other things other than neurodegenerative diseases like dementia and osteoporosis. It's also really bad for, it causes strokes. And that's why women have more strokes than men, even though men have more cardiovascular disease than women. Estrogen promotes basically every cancer, obviously breast cancer, but also for men, prostate cancer. Like, the estrogen is a major driver of all the cancers, blood cancers. So, you know, but that one's not really fraud, because I think everyone kind of understands breast cancers from estrogen, but it's not just breast cancer. So right, estrogen is a very harmful thing in excess. And for most people, it's very easy to have an excess of estrogen. It's very hard to have an excess of, you know, progesterone. So as an example, so
yeah,
don't be fooled to think that you need estrogen. You almost definitely don't need to take more estrogen. And if your estrogen is truly low, it's probably just because all your hormones are low and you just got to increase cholesterol turnover into other hormones that you're the solution is to take estrogen. So
yeah, that's the big one. Open the floodgates of the cholesterol so that they can do what they're meant to do.
Yeah. And you should listen to the first episode we did, if someone's wondering, well, how do I get cholesterol to turn into pregnenolone? It's too much to talk about now to rehash it, but listen to the first episode we did at the last half. Mm-hmm. We talked about many things, like about the protein, the carbs, and the minerals. Like, because I can't tell you, if someone's asking how do I increase my metabolism, like, you know, I don't know. You have to find out where you're lacking, and you might be lacking in carbs, you might be lacking in minerals, you might be lacking in protein, you might be eating the wrong fat. I can't tell. So it's a very context specific approach you have to take. And one last thing about the thyroid therapy, I don't think everyone needs thyroid therapy, and I definitely don't suggest it for most people, because thyroid therapy is really harmful if you're on, let's say, a low carb, low calorie, low protein diet. You shouldn't be taking any thyroid, gland or synthetic, unless, like, when I work with people, I have to make sure I know exactly what they're eating, generally how many calories and stuff, because I would be negligent to, you know, give my blessing on them taking a thyroid, even glandular product, which is very safe, but it's, you're setting yourself up for failure if you're, you know, keto carnivore, and then you're going to go take thyroid.
Or if you're just not eating well, because that's really,
eating well, eating enough, not eating carbs is a big thing. Cause a lot of people just think they need to lower carbs to be healthy. And you have a low carb diet plus a thyroid supplement, that's harmful. So there's so many things you can do other than take thyroid. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, if your TSH is like 7, I think it would be highly therapeutic to take thyroid glandular for a little. And some people might be annoyed with that. They might say, no, I want to just do it with foods, and that's fine. I'm not against that, and I'm very for that. But having said that, taking thyroid synthetic or glandular can be very therapeutic. It could change someone's, literally can change someone's life. And mm-hmm. we never talked, you asked me before, but we never end up talking about how I suggest dealing with thyroid glandular. So all I'll say on that is, one thing, the first thing of two, the first thing is that there's so many things you have to make sure you're doing before that. You need to be eating enough vitamin A. You need to be, because you need vitamin A, thyroid, and cholesterol to make hormones. So taking thyroid and a low vitamin A diet is a bad idea. You need to be eating enough carbs and enough food in general, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first step. So I'd listen to our first episode first to have a general idea. The second piece of advice, instead of me going through what I think you should do when you're taking thyroid glandular, I would just suggest reading the book Hypothyroidism, The Unsuspected Illness by Broda Barnes. You, any listener can pretty much figure it out themselves by just reading that book. And the two articles I mentioned on raypeat.com articles, the one TSH and the one thyroid therapy, you add those two articles plus Hypothyroidism, The Unsuspected Illness by Dr. Broda Barnes, and you'll be pretty good to go. But like I said, don't do this if your diet isn't good and you're eating.
Which is a common thing. People will take, you know, progesterone, they'll take, you know, all kinds of supplements. And meanwhile, they're, you know, having burgers and fries and pizza and just pasta, whatever. They're just eating whatever. And that's a huge problem. So that's something to be keen on for sure.
But just the one last thing, just to talk about how safe thyroid glandular is. If you read the Broda Barnes book that I mentioned, and I highly recommend anyone read it, even if you feel your thyroid's great, it's a great book to read. Very easy to read. You'll notice that he barely talks about him giving dietary advice to people. He does talk about it, but you'll read it and you'll have a client come to him, a patient come to him, because he's a doctor, and he'll test their temperature and it'll be low. And no matter what symptom they have, maybe they have ADHD or maybe they have fatigue or maybe they have chronic sinus infections, like every 2 months or so. He basically puts them on thyroid, and you can read this in the book, and he keeps increasing the dose every 2 weeks until their temperature's up. And that's all he really does, at least that's what he says in the book. So, you know, that's how safe it is, because he basically just gives it to people and keeps increasing the dose.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes months until he finds their temperature. And basically, Broda Barnes, I think he even says, I don't want to imply this is a panacea, but he basically shows that almost any health issue can be solved as long as you get your temperature to
37. Well, when Broda Barnes wrote that book, there weren't a lot of people doing the ketogenic diet though either, right? There weren't a lot of people going carb free back then, right?
Yeah, there might have been the Atkins diet, which I think is, anyway, low, that's carb. The point is, it is very safe.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have, because I don't think you'd really ask them what they were eating and they still all got better. Like, he basically prevented so many people from having heart attacks just by getting their temperature up.
Wow.
So I highly
recommend it. It is a good book.
Yeah. So read that book and listen to our first podcast and don't take estrogen. That's it.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. Okay. Thanks for hanging in there with us. I know it was a longer episode than usual, but I think my podcasts are going to start getting a little longer because the subject matter that we are all discussing is very thick and, you know, it's meaty. It's the meat and potatoes of things. And it's sometimes longer than an hour. A few of my guests that I had recently, I really wanted to keep them longer, like Keith Littlewood, Jay Feldman, all these people. I was like, man, I wish I had another hour with them. So I hope you got as much out of that as I did. One of the things that he really wanted to point out, and we kind of forgot because we kept having some bad Wi-Fi, was that, you know, hot flashes are not caused by low estrogen. And we are tricked into thinking that they are caused by low estrogen because we supplement estrogen and they go away, right? You have a headache, you take an aspirin or you take an Advil, your ibuprofen, and it goes, and the headache goes away. I must have cured it, right? And that's not what's happening. What I'm to understand from Ray Pete is that estrogen is almost like an emergency hormone, kind of like cortisol, right? It's coming in to raise cortisol, to normalize blood sugar, to block nitric oxide, and the nitric oxide is what's causing the hot flash. And so it comes in to regulate all that stuff, even though it's not ideally the way it should be handled. right? So getting your progesterone up, you know, having, taking care of your blood sugar levels, you know, your hangry moments. Like I know for me, I would wake up in the morning automatically, my cortisol would go up and my estrogen, I mean, my hot flashes, I'd get a hot flash in the morning. And so this was remedied by progesterone at night before bed. I would have a glass of orange juice by the bed. And that way your blood sugar doesn't crash and estrogen and cortisol don't come in to try to save the day. So that is the logic behind that. And there are other things to do, like supporting thyroid and all of these things we talked about in this last hour and a half in regards to the bigger picture, right? Not just taking the Advil for the headache, but figuring out what's causing the headache. And that's the deeper level there. So I hope that helped. And once again, you can go to us.onasnatural.com and you can use your coupon code DEAN, D-E-A-N, and get 10% off your order plus the multi-product discount. So if you get, you know, you just keep getting a discount for every product that you add to your cart, which is a very cool thing for Onas to do. And yeah, the progesterone is what I highly recommend. And you know, some people do take estrogen and they do well with it, but you have to ask yourself about those six markers that we talked about a couple podcasts ago. Okay, it might be helping with your libido, but is it helping with your mood, you know, your consistency of mood, your, you know, are you having an absence of pain? Are you sleeping through the night? Are you having a, you know, consistent energy throughout the day? And is your digestion good? You know, you can be taking estrogen and having your hot flashes go away. Maybe your libido is doing good, but meanwhile, you're not sleeping through the night. You have insulin resistance, your digestion is terrible, and you're putting on weight, right? So we have to try to tick the boxes of all those six markers of health. And we do that by digging and peeling the onion away and starting to look at the things we might be overlooking, right? Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to go back to my vacation in Florida and we will talk to you guys really soon.